It's Arnold Bjorn with Warm Welcome, a show about passionate people and how hospitality plays a part in what they do. I use an iPad for pretty much everything from editing and recording this podcast to staying on top of news and current trends. The one app that I use actually that's helpful for me at least is Flipboard. Flipboard curates the world's stories so you can be smarter in your work, life, and play. You can choose from thousands of topics to personalize your Flipboard and get the latest stories from the best publishers and experts delivered to you 24/7. Now, when you see these stories, you can just tap the plus button to add them to a private or public collection, and it's very simple. And you can get started now at flipboard.com. So on this episode, we talk a little bit about her origin story, growing up in a small town in Ohio, always dreaming and fantasizing about living in New York City, to outgrowing her 200 square feet space to her new and beautiful bigger space in Orchard Street, which carries over 50 different brands now and different price points. And there's just so many stories that she can tell. She has since then even written a book about pencils. She's really specialized in what she does, and it's always a special treat for us at the show to sit down with someone that's such an expert in their own world. So we talk a little about pencil, give a crash course on the history of pencils, of course, a little bit about her passion, about the business, some startup advice for anyone else that wants to get started in doing their own thing. And of course, we talk a little bit about hospitality and the importance of that and the aspect of her retail business.
I grew up in a town called Marietta, Ohio. It's a really tiny town, really historic little town on the Ohio River on the border of West Virginia. And both of my parents did jobs that involved using pencils, which is probably where I originally got this from. Yeah. My dad was an engineer and my mom's an interior designer. Grew up in a really creative household in a really strange tiny town with siblings, and we spent a lot of time traveling and seeing other things, because for them it was important that if we were going to live in this tiny town that we were exposed to other things. So they did a really good job of that. And I had this obsession forever with living in New York City before I even came here for the first time. And my mom took me here for my 13th birthday. And I've had a relationship with New York City ever since then. That was also one of the parts of the deal of going to school in a small town, was that my parents let me study in the summers in other places.
What was so intriguing about New York City when you were like 13 growing up? Was it just the big city, the big lights and all that, or?
Yeah, and I think like a lot of young people, I completely romanticized it because it was the opposite of what I was familiar with. And I like this idea of being able to live in a place where you can kind of be anonymous and where you can do anything. And the place I grew up, and like as far as career choices, as far as anything really, it was very, very limited. And even in the state of Ohio, like I just didn't feel like there was anything for me there. And I didn't know what that thing was yet necessarily, but I knew it wasn't there. So I became obsessed with this idea of living here. And yeah, I never really wanted to live anyplace else.
In terms of pencils, was there a moment that you can pinpoint where you found this love for pencils? Or was it just kind of a byproduct of your environment growing up with creative parents, do you think?
It was totally a byproduct of my environment. My mom had a drafting table in our dining room, and there was just like stuff everywhere all the time. And my dad used to fill our, my parents were divorced, so we did two Christmases. And my dad's Christmas, he used to fill our stockings with just like office supplies. He'd just go to Staples and just buy like every type of office supply. And that's what he'd put in our stockings. And I never thought that was weird because we were all really into it. We were like, oh, great. Like now we get to have our own staplers. It was like a really exciting thing. But there was a moment when I was about 6 years old and my mother went to Italy with her parents, and she came home and brought me a set of Caran d'Ache colored pencils that were in the most beautiful tin with wildflowers on the cover. And that I remember being the first object that as a child I like didn't want to totally ruin.
Wow.
And I still have them. They're still intact. They're not entirely used up. And the tin is still like in perfect condition. And I took really good care of these colored pencils. They were the first object that I remember just like completely glorifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of also then growing up with this passion and love for pencils and being around this environment, in terms of studying and higher education, did you go to, what did you go to school for ultimately?
I spent some time in New York actually before I went to college, just living on my own and working, and then thought, well, maybe there's something else. So I left and went to London and went to art school. I studied studio art at Goldsmiths College in Southeast London.
That's wild.
And it also was because I didn't know exactly where my place was, and that, and if I was going to go to college, and I did grow up in a family where that was an expectation,
right?
I thought that I should go somewhere where I don't necessarily learn a skill, but I learn how to see the world in a certain way. And like, wow. I never went to art school because I wanted to be an artist. I went because I wanted to like understand the world that way. I wanted to understand that visual language, which is sounds kind of strange when I say that now. But
yeah,
I had a great time. But still, by the end of my time in London, I was there for 4.5 years. I just really was ready to move back to New York.
That's a long time.
Yeah, it was a long time to live in another country and be away from home and be away from what's familiar. And it really made me appreciate certain things about my upbringing and about where I come from and about about New York too. Yeah. So I moved back here with really no idea of what I was going to do. I moved to New York straight from college just because there was no other place I felt like I could live.
So you went to art school in London and came back to New York City. What were you doing at that time when you first came back?
Well, I tried to find a job like all college graduates do. And I ended up working a retail job, which also involved a couple days of the week in an office doing online customer service. And that's where I really learned about having a retail store.
Did something click in your mind where it's like, it'd be cool if I had my, like, where was the connecting point here in terms of you wanting to start your own store or have your own thing?
Well, I had been thinking in the back of my head for a while that that was a thing I would end up doing, but that was something I kind of pictured like along the line. Yeah. I thought I'd like have a career doing something else and then I would be like I'd retire early and just be like an old lady in a shop and I'd get to talk to people all day. Like that's what I really thought it was going to be. And this idea for a pencil shop had been a thing that I'd kind of been joking about for many years. And I had no intention of actually doing it because I thought like there's no way that this could survive financially. And I just, there was nothing to compare it to. I couldn't do any market research. So it wasn't a thing I really thought I was going to do.
Yeah.
But I thought like, well, I'm trying to figure out what I want to do. It makes sense to have a retail job because it's something that I'm interested in.
Right.
It's a good way to meet people also when you're new in a city. I made a lot of friends through that job. It just seemed like a good way to, I guess, spend my time and make some money in the meantime.
Yeah.
Having spent some time there, and yeah, I guess I kind of also discovered some ways that I would want to do that differently,
right.
Which I found quite frustrating. And then I really just had a terrible winter. That first winter I was in New York, I somehow got Lyme disease in the middle of January in Manhattan. Like I didn't leave at all. I don't know how I got it, but I just like felt terrible. I hated my job. Just having a really bad winter. And I truly just woke up one day and thought like, you know what? I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to do it. And that was that.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And so CW Pencil Enterprise, first of all, obviously it stands for your name, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, it started first as an online store. Is that correct?
Yeah. I started by reaching out to brands I was familiar with and liked all over the world and convinced them to sell me their products, which I kept in the closets of my apartment. And I spent a good few months trying to just figure it out on my own. Like it was really important to me that I didn't subcontract anything in the process of starting this business, because I thought if I'm going to do this, like there's a very real possibility that I won't be able to afford to have people do things for me, or it'll be a long time before I have employees. So I took my time. I really took my time. It took me a whole summer to get it all set up because I just really wanted to do it right. And I wanted to know everything about everything that I was doing.
Right.
So I built the website myself. I did all the product photography. I did all the research. And yeah, I launched the website in November of 2015.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in terms of that turning into a store, when did that materialize?
Well, that was something that I was going to wait on for a while because I needed to know that I was going to make money doing this, first of all.
Right.
Of course, because I really thought like, well, maybe people will buy this stuff, but I might also have to get a regular job again and just do this on the side. But I discovered a community of people online through actually a podcast called The Erasable Podcast, which is about pencils. And they were my first customers, really. And they kind of like spread the word about this little business I had. Yeah. And they were all kind of like, well, where did this person come from? She just like came out of nowhere like made this shop. And around the same time, I happened upon a space on Forsyth Street. I started thinking about a shop, like wasn't going to do it anytime soon. I was just trying to understand like what it costs and like what kind of neighborhood I would want to be. And then I just randomly happened upon this space on Forsyth between Grand and Broom on the Lower East Side. And it just felt right. It was tiny. It was 200 square feet. It was a couple of steps above street level. And it was really affordable. My rent when I first opened there was $1,900 a month. And it didn't require much of a build out either. Like I did most of it myself. And I just trusted my gut and just kind of did it. I think that's one of the good things about doing something this crazy so young was that I was so naive about it. There was nothing stopping me. So
that is really wild, right? Thinking back on it now, you're just jumping right into it. I mean, was your online shop a hit? Like, would you have a lot of success and customers? Or tell us more about that time too. Like, what period was like for you?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like an overnight success. It's not like I was all of a sudden like overwhelmed with orders, but it was steady. It was steady and it was regular, and there was real interest. Yeah. And I think that's all I needed to know to feel confident about it, because I couldn't do any market research. There was nothing else like this. So there was nothing to base any assumptions off of. And so I also was very aware of the fact that having a physical space would really change things, because there's a physical presence. There's a place for people to happen upon when they're walking down the street. There's a place for people to write about in publications and photograph and Instagram. And I knew that that was something that was going to be important eventually. And I just kind of, when I found the right space, that felt right. And I thought like, okay, I can see my stuff in here. I can see myself in here. Right. I know exactly how I want to design it. Right. There was no question about anything. I just thought like, okay, well, this is a space that I want people to find.
Yeah.
And so I just went for it. It was probably a little premature. I probably should have waited. It would have been a little smarter, but I went into it like truly thinking that it was just going to be like me and my tiny shop for like many, many years before anything happened. And the day I opened, I didn't really tell very many people because I was terrified. Like the few people who I told, especially like when I told strangers, like when they ask, when you meet somebody like in a bar or something and they ask what you do. Yeah, and I told them like, well, I'm opening a pencil shop. They like thought I was joking. And so I got really tired of having to explain myself to people. So
I just didn't bother.
I just didn't tell anyone. Yeah. Like I just kind of like made up some excuse as to why I wasn't really working. And I told like my family, of course, and like my close friends. And that was about it. I just kind of did it and like waited for people to come.
Yeah. That brick and mortar aspect of your business though is so important, right? Because pencils, like the product you're selling, is something that's just so physical and tangible, and you have to like feel the pencils and actually and you also have a testing station at your store, so I think that aspect to it is really, really important though, and in terms of like what you're selling, right?
Yeah, totally. Like there's only so much I can explain online about how a thing feels, and I mean it's a tactile object, it's a utilitarian object, you're supposed to use it. So when I was designing the space, I really wanted it to just be like comfortable, and I wanted people to feel like there was no pressure and that they could come in and they could just play and just talk to somebody and stay for as long as they wanted to.
Yeah. How was the first year that you were open with the store? What was the reception like for you?
It was not anything that I expected it to be, and my expectations were very low. But I opened the shop in, I guess it was March of 2016. I had customers right away. I had a friend, my best friend was working for me on Sundays just so I could have a day off. Wow. And within the first month, I hired my first part-time employee because we were getting like busy enough. And Gothamist wrote about the shop, and then that just like had a major snowball effect.
It's like a wildfire, huh?
It was crazy. Like by like early May, there was a huge article about it in the New York Times. And I remember that day it came out. I was in the middle of moving into a new apartment. And I remember I was sitting on the countertop in my empty apartment. And I opened up the app. We use Shopify as our POS, and I opened up the Shopify app and saw that we just had like a ton of orders all of a sudden. I was like, what's happening? And I knew this article was coming out, but I didn't know when, and I had no idea. I literally thought it was going to be like a picture and a caption. I didn't know it was going to be an actual article, and then I found it online and was like, uh-oh, I don't know what I'm going to do. It was just me and my one part-time employee who was also leaving town for a week. And the day it came out in print, like, there was like a line to get into the shop. I sold out of everything.
No way.
And I closed that day. I closed like 2 hours late because it was just so busy.
Wow.
And I just locked the door, turned the lights off, and called my mom and just cried and told her, like, I can't do this. I have to like close for a week just to recover. Like, this is not something I can handle. And she was like, no, you can't do that. Like, you have a business now. You really can't do that. And I made it through. I had a lot more press after that. And within, I guess, before we even had a 1 year anniversary, I had 4 employees and an office down the street. We ended up like outgrowing that space already. So we had to get a second space just to fulfill online orders.
That's crazy.
It was crazy. Like, I think about it now and it sounds crazy. It sounds really crazy, but at the time, like, I was just doing what I had to do. Like, every day was just like trying to solve this problem of how do we do all of this in one day. And we figured it out, and I found good people to help me. Yeah. And it's just been a steady stream since then. The growth has been so natural. Like, I haven't even done anything. People ask me all the time, like, how what's your marketing strategy and all this? And I'm like, I literally don't have one. Like, I've never spent any money on marketing or advertising because I've been lucky. I haven't had to, but. Yeah.
The impact of New York Times is so real, huh?
It's crazy. Yeah. Like, it's truly crazy. And I was not prepared for that. I wish that I had somebody to tell me what would happen. Yeah. And it was a really good article too. It was very flattering. It was a really, really good article.
It read very well.
Yeah, I understand why people read that and then like immediately had to come to my shop. But it's been a wild ride, that's for sure. I feel like it'll be our 4 year anniversary of opening a physical shop next month.
And
I feel like I'm only just now like having time to actually take on additional projects and like actually just breathe and like enjoy my business. Yeah. It's been crazy.
So you probably had the highest of highs during this time, but you know, as with highs come lows, and I know that there were challenges also with that store in particular, and I kind of would like to dive into that a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, the New York Times article came out, press is hot, people are coming by your store. Tell us a little bit about that growing pain, but also maybe when you kind of had to close that store.
I mean, it got to a point where we had a lot of regular customers and that we just didn't have the space and the shop was too small. And it's so important to me to interact with every single person who comes through the door. And you can't do that when you can't fit more than one staff member in the shop at a time. And like there's 20 people who need help. And we ended up having to move. We didn't have a choice in the matter because our building was sold and the new landlord got renovated the entire building and caused a really big water problem that then led to a mold problem that led to us like having to move because it just wasn't safe anymore and led to a lawsuit. And it was a very messy move. It was well timed because we really were outgrowing that space and our second space. Like, I was looking for a third space. And I was so attached to the shop because it was just so perfect to me. And it was exactly how I wanted it. And I didn't want to have to, like, expand.
Yeah.
That was never part of my plan originally. And so I had to. I didn't have a choice. And I looked at the block on Orchard Street between Canal and Hester just because I really liked that block. And it's in this nice end of the neighborhood, like on the cusp of Chinatown.
Yeah,
where like there aren't any chain businesses yet. And it's just people who live there and there's a lot of foot traffic and all the other small businesses are just really genuine small businesses who have really great involved owners. And it's like a little community. It's nice. I feel like I like work in Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. It's wonderful. And so that's where I wanted to be. And I found a space that was a little above my budget, if I'm being honest. And it was beautiful and huge, like a little over 3 times our original shop, and had a giant finished basement, which meant that I could consolidate my 2 spaces and do everything from one space.
In one space, yeah.
And I was basically just fell in love with this space. And then I met the landlord, and the landlord is just a lady who owns a building, who lives upstairs, who also owns a shop, who just really wanted a responsible responsible tenant who she could get along with. And yeah. I thought, like, okay, this is the best possible scenario. I don't care if it's a little over my budget.
Right.
Like, we're going to make it work. And now it's been a year and a half since we reopened in that space. And it was totally the right decision.
Yeah. To give like a 101 on pencils, maybe like a quick brief history on pencils, you know, what are pencils made out of? I would love for you to go dive into this passion of pencils that you have and share with us a little bit about it.
So graphite was first discovered in the middle of the 1500s. But the pencil, as we know it, cased in wood, didn't come to be until about 100 years later. And even then it was made by cabinet makers, people who were very skilled with woodcraft. And the earliest pencils resembled basically like a carpenter pencil, like we know now, where it's rectangular, because these people literally cut like a rectangular strip of pure graphite and just kind of like boxed it in. That was the easiest way to do it. And it wasn't really until the Industrial Revolution that people really figured out how to like mechanize it and make them the way that we see them now.
Yeah.
But there were plenty of very early pencil makers who were still making them by hand and selling them as a commodity. Like John Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau's father, was one of the earliest pencil makers in the United States in the mid-1800s. That's what Henry David Thoreau did before he became a writer. He made pencils with his father.
No way.
Yeah, he played a big role in improving the way that the core of the pencil was made. Yeah, long before he became a writer.
He
left the pencil business and like went to Walden Pond and then came back and kind of like dabbled in pencils for a while and then took over the business and then eventually sold it. But so there's a lot of interesting history with early pencils being made by hand.
Yeah.
But it really wasn't until, I guess, the late 1800s, in the early 1900s, that they became like an affordable, really super accessible commodity.
Oh, so was it before this time an expensive tool?
It kind of was, and they weren't, like, they worked, but they weren't, like, there were problems. Like, it took a long time to figure out how to make the core of a pencil so that it was strong, so that it wrote smoothly.
Right.
It was actually an engineer that was contracted by a general who worked for Napoleon in France, who came up with the way to make the modern pencil core, which is still to this day how we make it, if you can imagine.
Nuts, yeah.
It's nuts. And so he figured out that if you take graphite and you grind it to fine powder and refine it, and you mix it with powdered clay and water, of course, and then fire it in a kiln like you would ceramics, it makes a really strong, really durable, very smooth pencil core.
Mm.
And he was the first one to discover that. And so truly to this day, that's how a pencil
that revolutionized
made.
Everything.
Completely revolutionized it. And then the Industrial Revolution happened. And then you had people like Joseph Dixon of Dixon Ticonderoga. He was an inventor. He didn't even like originally work in pencils. He was a really prolific inventor before he even started making pencils. And he became obsessed with the idea of making pencils. And so he's one of the in the U.S., at least, one of the people who really figured out how to mechanize it. And he had a factory in Jersey City where he made graphite crucibles, was his main business. That's how he made his money, was making graphite crucibles. And he had like half of the factory where he made pencils, and the pencils didn't make any money for like the first like probably like 30 years that they were making them. They were losing money on pencils because it was just a passion project. Like, he was just trying to figure it out.
Right.
And eventually they did. And his son-in-law took over, and now Dixon Ticonderoga is the most recognized pencil in America.
Yeah.
But, for the bulk of the 20th century, there were just tons of pencil makers in the U.S., who were making really interesting pencils that were really different. And, I guess at the height of the pencil industry, probably in like the 1940s, 1950s, there were over 50 pencil manufacturers in the U.S., almost none of which exist now. There are only three left in the U.S. now.
Really?
Mm-hmm. They've all either been consolidated or closed or moved overseas.
Yeah.
But the pencil is an object that's just so universal. Like, every culture knows what it is,
right,
uses it. And there are so many manufacturers that exist in the world even today who no one knows about because they truly just make pencils for their domestic market to serve the need of the people in the place where they live. And most of these companies are family owned, and they're also quite often like well over 80 years old. Like, there's no such thing as a new pencil company. They just don't exist because this type of equipment isn't necessarily standardized. So all of it's like proprietary to the business that is making pencils, and or it's equipment that was bought by a defunct pencil company and has been refurbished. So it's really, really, really hard to start a new pencil factory. Yeah. Nobody would ever, I wouldn't even try to do it.
Yeah.
It would be nearly impossible. And so I, as my fascination with pencils grew, I became really interested in the histories and the stories of the people who make them and why certain pencils from certain places are the way that they are.
Like, right.
Why the Japanese ones are so good and why the German ones are so scratchy. And a lot of it's cultural. And along the way, I discovered all these tiny, tiny, tiny companies that really I'd never heard of. And like nobody in the U.S. has ever heard of, because like, why would you? Like, there's a company called Shawson's in Pakistan, and they don't export their pencils hardly out of Pakistan, let alone Southeast Asia. Like, you get them sometimes in other parts of the Middle East, and especially in parts of Southeast Asia, but that's it. And it's like those people and those stories that I eventually became very interested in uncovering. Yeah.
How do you seek out these kind of pencils that people have never heard of? Like, where are you looking? And
A lot of late night internet deep dives, to be honest. But a lot. Well, I mean, in the past couple of years, it's been very easy because people know about the shop now, and they know about me. And so I don't have to try very hard because people just come to me and tell me about stuff. When
samples,
they discover something they've never seen before, they'll email me a picture and be like, what is this? Like, what can you tell me about it? I've kind of become a little bit of an anthropologist for pencils. And it's fun for me because I have a lot more resources now to figure out this information. And at the time, like, there were so many things where I just couldn't figure out where they came from or how to get them. And so I just kind of kept this like mental log of like mysterious pencils I was trying to find and didn't know how to find. But I've done a lot of traveling to find a lot of these things, and I've asked a lot of questions. I've met a lot. I've reached out to a lot of people who know more than I do.
Yeah,
at this point, we sell pencils from, I think, over 13 different countries, mostly general use pencils. We have drawing pencils and like specialty pencils, colored pencils, all of that. But I'm more interested in pencils that just like regular people use, like something that you just use at work every day or use to write your grocery list or use to like write in your journal. And they all feel different. Even the pencil grading scale is not universal. Like, using an HB or a number 2 by a German company against one that is made in Japan feels so different, like a completely different writing instrument.
What has changed the perception of pencils, and why have people kind of strayed away from that into more maybe mechanical pencils or even pens?
Well, it's really had to do with technology, that people just in general, even outside of pencils, like don't write as much as they used to because they don't have to. They have phones, they have laptops, they have iPads, like they have other means of communication, and they also have other means of doing their work.
Right.
Especially so a lot of these really like weird specialty pencils have no use anymore. Mm-hmm. And in certain cultures, it's different. Like, there are many, many cultures where they actually do real paperwork and where it's much more formal as far as like, I guess, business expectations go. But for the most part, it's not a necessary tool anymore for like most people in most industries, which is definitely the reason why a lot of these pencil factories don't exist anymore. But I think that's also the reason why a lot of them do, because as we've kind of strayed away from that, the more it's kind of taken on this new life of being like a kind of like kind of a novelty analog object. And I hate to use the word novelty, but that's really what it is.
Yeah.
People use it because they think like, oh, this is like, how funny is it that I'm like using a pencil? Or they're using it because they crave that tactile experience with an object doing something. And I've done a lot of talking about the effects on handwriting things, and it's better for your brain. It helps you remember things better. It's just a completely different way of doing things. And I think that in general, as a culture, we've kind of had enough time to naturally stray away from that now people are starting to crave it a little bit and kind of remember. Yeah, they appreciate it a lot more. And they kind of remember, like, maybe if I made my lists on paper, I'll remember them better. Or maybe it's a good idea to keep a physical planner. Or maybe I should start journaling again. And like, bullet journaling is a huge trend. People love doing that. And there are a lot of like analog activities that have had a real resurgence in the past few years, even just because they're almost treated as hobbies more mm-hmm. than a necessity. Like letter writing, for example. Like that's we have a letter writing society that meets at the shop once a month, and it's wonderful. And a lot of these people are people who never thought about writing a letter until they started hearing about this sort of thing. And and it's not necessary. They do it for fun. It's a hobby. It's not, you're not writing to your mom because it's the only way to communicate with her. Right. It's not like that anymore. Really. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's my job to bring all of these amazing objects and stories to light and to show people like a pencil isn't the thing that you buy at Staples mm-hmm. for a pack of 24 for a dollar. Like that's not it. Like there are so many of these pencils that are accessible. They're inexpensive. They're even sometimes kind of exotic, and they're so pleasurable to write with. A really, like, nothing beats a really good pencil that like is well centered. It sharpens nicely. It doesn't break. It feels like something, and it smells like something, and it's yeah. painted beautifully. Like, that's a thing that people, I think, forget even exists.
Mm.
So it's my job to kind of remind them, like, mm-hmm. yes, pencils can be really lovely, and you just don't know because they're just not accessible anymore.
Yeah. Something that I think is important to talk about, too, is you are so knowledgeable about pencils, obviously, compared to anyone else that I know, at least. And being that you're someone that's such an expert at something like this, you don't come off as a condescending person, because I think it is easy to become kind of a snob, really, if you know a lot about something. But how do you then translate what you do and your passion for this into your store, or how do you make this topic approachable for people?
Well, to be honest, it's really just about storytelling. Like everything I do just is about storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I don't expect anybody to care about the entire history of the pencil. If they want to do that, great. Like read my book. It's really interesting. Like that's why I wrote it. But for just everyday people who come into my shop, I just want to open their eyes a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I only share as much as I feel like they're willing to hear. And most people who come in are really excited. They're as excited as I am. And they're just really interested in knowing why this shop exists and yeah. why people buy this stuff. And yeah, and it's my job to help them understand. And like I tell everybody who works in the shop, like this is not a job where it's about selling things. We don't have sales goals. We've never had sales goals. We just want to make people feel like they've had a really cool experience and like they've learned something. And that in its own way translates to sales, and yeah. we don't have to even worry about that.
Yeah.
There's a story behind every object we sell, even if it's just like we sell some paper goods, even if it's just like about the guy who is a friend of ours who makes these notebooks in a letterpress studio. Like everything that we sell has a story.
Yeah.
So people come in and we always greet them and we always ask them if they're looking for anything, and we tell them where the test station is and right. like make it clear, like, please sit down, try all these things, like they're here for you to use. And we answer questions and we make a lot of recommendations and we tell the stories of the things that people are interested in. Mm-hmm. And if they have a story to attach to an object, they're so much more interested.
I think it's so empowering also as an employee, knowing that there aren't like numbers you have to meet necessarily, but more so it's about the experience that the guest has. Whenever you carry like a new product, do you have like an informational guide for your employees to learn more about that product so they can kind of share that story? Or how do you go about educating your employees?
I make sure everybody knows what the deal is. I make sure that they test it out. I make sure that they have as much of an understanding of it as they can.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, they're very receptive to that. Like I've been really lucky. I've had really, really good employees, and I've really hardly ever had to advertise for jobs because these people just come to me.
Yeah.
Because it's so specific, I really trust the kind of people who are willing to like reach out yeah. of the blue to email me about a job. And I think it is easy. It's easier to care about what you do when you don't have a lot of like looming expectations that may or may not be reasonable, like yeah. sales goals and things like that.
Yeah.
Like I think it makes them care a little bit more.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, I've been to your store a total of two times, once at the original store and once at the new one. And all the interactions that I've had with the people that work there have been very honest and genuine. I felt like they were literally, even if I were to walk out the store and not have purchased anything, like, they would have been okay with that.
Yeah.
And that's so empowering for me, because I'm like, okay, then I can always come back and know that whatever they're recommending to me is literally just genuinely they're also very excited about this product.
Yeah.
You know, and that I think that's awesome.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I'm glad. Yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do. Like, there are many times when people pick up something really expensive and they ask me about it and they tell me what they want to use it for. And I'll tell them, like, to be honest, like, you don't need to spend that kind of money to do what you're trying to do. Like, yeah. let's try this instead.
Yeah.
And those are the people who become regular customers and who do come back when they want to buy. Because they trust that we're going to be honest.
Yeah.
And they trust that, like, we care enough about the objects that we sell that we're not we're not going to try to upsell them just for the sake of a sale, because we want them to go home and actually use the things that they bought and enjoy them. Yeah, that's really important. And the number one thing is that we want them to feel comfortable coming back.
Mm-hmm.
We want them to feel like if they're in the neighborhood and they have 10 minutes to kill, like they can just come in and talk to us. I want everybody to feel like we're their friend.
Yeah.
And I think we do a pretty good job of that. I think that's why we've survived longer than I think most people expected us to.
I would love to segue this into the topic of hospitality, because I think this is just on point with what I wanted to talk about. And this is something I ask all the guests that are on the show. For you, that word hospitality, what does it mean to you?
It means just making somebody feel unconditionally welcome, making them feel like you don't have any expectations of them.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, you're there to provide a service, but beyond that service, like the interaction can go as far as they want it to go, and that they're in control of that.
Mm-hmm.
That we're not there to be pushy, and we're not there to sell them something. We're there to share something that we care about with them. And I think like even outside of like retail stores, any restaurant or hotel or like any place that is like a public service place that I encounter, like I'm always taking notes of how they do things well and how I don't like the way that they're doing things, because I'm a person with a lot of anxiety too. So like for me, like feeling welcome somewhere is very important. And feeling like I just feel comfortable around the people I'm interacting with is super important. So yeah, I just want people to feel unconditionally welcome.
That's really awesome, because I think you recognize this before a lot of all the other like retail stores are recognizing this, and I think they're trying to compensate it by adding like a coffee shop or adding in like more of an F&B outlet to it, right? And I think that aspect of making things more conversational than transactional is so important to what you do.
Yeah, it totally is. And I think it drives me crazy when people are like always changing their concept or they're trying to do more things than they need to. I'm like, just do one thing really well. Like that's all you have to do to have a successful business, is do one thing as well as you can possibly do it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it breaks my heart when I go into shops that look really beautiful and sell like even some that sell like a specific type of object. And I feel this way about a lot of other stationery stores too, that like you go in, the staff don't really care to engage. They don't really know about their products, and everything's like set up in a certain way. So it just looks really precious.
Mm.
Like you're not allowed to touch it. Mm. Like it's just there to serve
an aesthetic. Instagram.
Yeah, yeah. Like it's just there to serve an aesthetic purpose, and that's it. And I mean, those are the kind of shops that I feel unwelcome in, the ones that just feel like they take themselves too seriously. And I think it's really important to avoid that when you have a retail shop, because at the end of the day, it is a public space that people need to want to be in order for it to function as a public space.
Yeah.
And you can't make money and you can't like make people feel welcome if you're giving them this impression that the thing that you do is superior to like anything they're going to do with the objects that they're buying from you, or that nobody wants to engage with you because they don't actually know anything about like a notebook they're trying to sell you for $40 like that. Yeah. It just, that really just makes me frustrated.
Yeah. And that's what's so different about your store, right? Is the attention to and the love for the products that you sell, as opposed to, like you said, like just trying to do a little bit of everything. You're definitely a specialty store.
Yeah.
And
I want people to have an experience. And if otherwise, like, why would I even have a retail store? Like the point of going to a retail store is to have an experience that you can't have looking at a computer and ordering something online. So if you're not giving somebody that experience, they might as well be shopping online. Like,
That's
what's true. The point of even paying rent in New York City?
Right. Why do you think you're so passionate about what you do?
Well, I'm really lucky. I got to invent my own job. Like the longer I do this, the more I realize like, wow, this is really remarkable that this is what I get to do every day.
Mm-hmm.
That there are days that I go to work and we just like get to pick out Pantone swatches for products that like imaginary products that we might want to make. Like I'm passionate about it. And I always have been, just because I'm really interested in the history of objects and this one object in particular.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the longer I do this and the more other people I meet who are already passionate about it or become passionate about it because of what we do to help them with that, like that just makes me love it even more. Like I really love my job because I'm around other people who love the things that I sell as much as I do. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about having a shop like mine is that because it's not a necessary service that we're providing, the type of people who come in, like we never really have any grumpy people coming in. We never have any angry people coming in. Like people come in just because they really just want to be there.
Mm.
So it's really wonderful. Like I'm just surrounded by really positive, excited people every day.
What's next for you and this company that you have, especially with this new year? Like what are you trying to focus on?
Honestly, I'm just trying to take it easy and just enjoy my business. I really have no interest in opening more shops.
Yeah.
Because that would mean that I have to be in an office every day just doing like buying and admin tasks and managing staff. And that's not why I signed up to do this. I signed up to do this because I really like the thing that I'm selling and I want to be able to talk to people about it. And the bigger we grow, the less I get to do that. Mm. And I don't want that. Like I could do that. There are other places where I could open shops and I could easily get the capital I need to do that. But I'm just not interested. I'm really happy just doing it the way that we're doing it. And we are going to develop some more of our own products. That's a fairly new thing for us. Just in the past couple of years, we're developing some new products and we're going to start wholesaling some of our own products other shops.
Yeah.
But beyond that, like I just like my job. So I'm just going to stay put. Yeah. I don't want to leave New York. I don't.
That's great.
I don't want to like it's for the thing that we do, I think, is there's a certain amount of like magic with a shop like ours. And that would be so hard to replicate anyplace else.
Yeah.
Like it would be so hard. And I don't even want to try because I just don't want to ruin a good thing. And I think like, yeah, as far as growth goes, like I know people, it's like kind of strange for me to say like, nope, don't want to grow. Like I'm good the way things are. But honestly, that's the truth. Like we can always do more online sales. Like that's a cool thing. Like that's great. Like we'll continue doing that. And that kind of happens naturally. But
yeah,
I'm not going anywhere. We're staying on Orchard Street for a very long time.
Great. For anyone that wants to keep up with what you do and follow along, what's the best way to follow with CW Pencil Enterprise?
We are analog people, so we are not good at internet things, but we love Instagram. So you can find us on Instagram at CW Pencil Enterprise. Our website is cwpencils.com, and we are also on Facebook and Twitter, though we don't really use them.
The best option is just to stop by and say hello
to beautiful come by, people. Introduce yourself, hang out for a little bit. Yeah.
Awesome. Caroline, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Of course.
As we close out another episode of With Warm Welcome, I just want to take the time to thank Caroline for her time, to Anchor for giving us the space as usual to record. For next week, stay tuned as we kind of chat with an international guest, Mikkel, who is the founder of a magazine called Standart. Standart is a magazine about coffee and cafe culture and really uncovers the world of specialty coffee, which is a world that I'm also personally passionate about. I also just want to share that the website is live. You can find the website on withwarmwelcome.com, and I'll be soon starting a newsletter as well that would complement the website, and that would also complement the episodes that come out every week. It's a way to let people know that there's an episode and maybe even provide a little bit of commentary as well. So stay tuned. Definitely more on the newsletter. Maybe next week I'll talk a little bit more about it on the show. Thanks again.